This is February 3rd, 2008, and today I'm going to talk about discontent and contentment. I haven't come up with the official title yet, but that's that basic stuff. There is a koan in the Bluecliff record collection that's called Ummon's Medicine and Sickness Are in Correspondence to Each Other. So I'm just going to start with this short koan and go from there. Ummon said, this Ummon is great Chinese master, Zen master from the Tang Dynasty, roughly the 8th or 9th century. Ummon said to his disciples, "Medicine and sickness are in correspondence to each other. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself?" We used to, for the translation of this title, we used to have medicine and sickness cure each other. But I changed that because it's just... this doesn't make sense linguistically. Yes, medicine, medicine cures sickness, but in what way can we say that, in any sense, that sickness cures medicine? I mean, cure implies there's some kind of problem, and medicine in and of itself doesn't have a problem. So I dug up all kinds of other translations. The one I just read, medicine and sickness are in correspondence to each other. Medicine and sickness fit each other, are appropriate for each other, correspond to each other. I think basically it's pointing to the mutual conditioning, the indivisibility of medicine and sickness. Of course, the sickness here is the sickness of human beings, the sickness of sentient existence, dukkha. Dukkha is one of these rich Sanskrit words. It's the, most of you know, this is the first of the famous Four Noble Truths that the Buddha pronounced at his first formal discourse at Deer Park. This was right after his Great Awakening. He walked to this beautiful green park right outside Varanasi, Benares at the time, near the Ganges, and he proclaimed these Four Noble Truths, the first of which is the truth of dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, but it's a much more complex, elusive word than simply suffering. The word that I have preferred, always preferred, another, this probably the second most common translation is unsatisfactory, unsatisfactoriness. And that's what I want to focus on in the Teisho, this unsatisfactoriness of life. I got to thinking about this recently. Someone gave me an article from the Wall Street Journal, of all places, in which a very short article where someone who apparently is a Buddhist, it's hard to tell, makes the case for makes a case for teaching Buddhism to children as a religion. He cites some statistic that in at Dharma centers in the West, the average age is upward of 50. And he makes the case that if something doesn't change in the next 20 or 30 years, there isn't going to be much Buddhism left in the West, in the United States, in Europe, and the Americas. And this is not something I take lightly, given my own responsibility to preserve the Dharma, and after all of the work here to build the center and Chapin Mill and all, what will happen in the future? Because it is still mostly people of the baby boom generation who are drawn to this practice. Until I read this statistic that he cites, I wasn't sure. It was impressionistic on my part from my participation, my occasional participation in the annual meeting of American Zen teachers, hearing their reports about participation and demographics, who joins and who stays. You know, from the biggest, deepest perspective, we could say the absolute point of view, the ultimate perspective, we have nothing to worry about with the Dharma. The Dharma is just fine as it is. It always will be. Even if people aren't practicing it, the Dharma is beyond a religion. It's beyond membership. Dharma is this. Here, this is it. I don't mean Zen Buddhists listening to Taisho or giving Taisho. I mean just reality. That's not going anywhere. Even if the world is destroyed, that too is reality. That's the Dharma. So from that perspective, well, there's nothing to talk about. You know, we could just burn down Arnold Park and Chapin Mill, and so what? But so let's leave that perspective out. that wag who just made that remark is referring to when the center. For those of you who don't know. In 1968, there was a fire here, this very building we're sitting in, and this whole building was gutted. There was little left except the shell of this house. What they thought at the time was just the worst kind of calamity turned out to be not the worst kind of calamity, because we were able to rebuild it as a Zen center for our own function, our own purpose. Until the fire, it was a comfortable residential home, the home of the Morse Lumber Company owner. So I got to thinking, what is it? Why don't more young people, or we could just say any people, because there are millions of people in the baby boom generation who also aren't attracted to the Dharma. But why, what is it that draws someone to this practice or doesn't? I just sat with this morning and came up with three parts to this. There's dukkha, which we were just talking about, the basic unsatisfactoriness of worldly existence. There is the awareness of that dukkha, the awareness of the dukkha, and then the third thing is an affinity with the Dharma. So let's take these one by one. First, the first two, dukkha and the awareness of dukkha, we can see them as two, and we can see them as one. We can see them as two aspects of one thing, or we can break them, or we can see them as one. So the word dukkha means the best simple short translation of it is that when the Buddha said, this is the first noble truth of dukkha, he was saying that all conditioned events are unsatisfactory. All conditioned events. Condition just means anything that's subject to causes and conditions. That means all phenomena, really. All phenomena. All conditioned events. Events could not be, he couldn't have limited it to just, you know, things that happen as we normally think of events. I think he meant more broadly, he would include us as events. Since we are, we're not just static nouns. Any one of us is not a noun. We're each one of us is a verb. We are in process. John is Johning. Mary is marrying. It's a wonderful revelation. When I first heard in the Hopi language, there are almost no nouns. Everything is a verb. So they don't see a tree, they see treeing. Or they would see carring. This is very Buddhistic perspective on life, that everything is in flux, everything is happening. Each one of us is happening. Also, all conditioned events are unsatisfactory. In what sense? Well, the first, you can break this down, but the most obvious sense of unsatisfactoriness is simple physical pain. Physical pain is our lot. To be a sentient being is to experience physical pain more or less frequently. And generally, as we age, it becomes more frequently. And this is something that is unavoidable. The Buddha never said that we can eliminate physical pain. What we can do, however, is change our experience of that pain, which is pretty close to eliminating it, or certainly managing it or lessening it. But nonetheless, we have this fact of physical pain. And because the physical is so intimately connected to the psychological, we also have the fact of psychological pain. I don't see these as really so different. We are beings of hormones. We have this. We are biochemical organisms. That and these biochemical processes affect our emotions, our feelings. So I would suggest that we can no more eliminate psychological pain, emotional pain, than we can eliminate physical pain. But as with physical pain, we can change the way we experience to our emotional pain, our psychological pain. Still, there it is, physical pain, psychological pain, emotional pain. We're stuck with this as long as we live. This is it. And that's one meaning of this basic dukkha. In that sense, it's a given. It's a condition of worldly existence, of samsaric existence, if you will. Another aspect to this dukkha is our wanting to secure what can't be secured, which can be all kinds of things. Wanting to secure our financial status, wanting to have a secure home life, wanting to secure the health and well-being of our children, wanting to secure a happy marriage, wanting to secure happiness, period. And this would fall under dukkha because we can't ultimately secure anything forever. We can have good physical health for a while. We can have good memory for a while. We can have beauty for a while. We can have the perfect house for a while and the perfect children for a while till they become teenagers. So this also is embedded in this wanting to have things our way. This itself is unsatisfactory because they won't ever remain the way. Even if we could make things our way, if we could manage to get things, reach such a state of control of our world, our environment, that we could make it all just the way we want, it wouldn't stay that way. So that's another kind of dukkha, wanting to substantiate, to fix things. And then maybe another kind would be other kinds of wanting to change what can't be changed. I wish I didn't have this body. I wish I didn't have this face. I wish I wouldn't have so much pain in my knees, or wish I wouldn't get bald, or I wish I wouldn't get fat, or I wish I were of a different race, or born to different parents. So wanting to change what can't be changed, wanting to have what we can't have. Wish I had that person as my spouse instead of the one I have. I wish I had $1 million. Wanting to relate in a way we can't relate. Wanting to be what we can't be. Wanting to do what we can't do. And all of these, you notice, all of it comes from this basic wanting, or to use a more basic Buddhist word, craving. Craving. So we could say that all of this is the kind of sickness that Ummon was referring to in his statement in this koan. Now, a little different from this is the second part of these three that I outlined, which is the awareness of this. Now, this, go with me on this, because it may not seem to make much sense, but I think it holds up, that we can be suffering in all these ways of endlessly wanting, grasping, craving, and not recognize it as suffering. This reminds me of anger. We can be angry without being aware of our anger. I hope people can accept this, because I think it is the most important thing about dealing with anger. is when we're really, especially when we're really angry, when we're really tantruming, we get so single-mindedly focused on the object of our anger that we lose self-awareness. Our whole world is that person and what I would say to him or her and what I would have done to him or her. And there we lose, we slip into a state of oblivion, or we lose self-awareness. There's no other way, better way of putting it than that. We lose self-awareness. And speaking from experience, we can go through years of these different kinds of craving that I just mentioned under dukkha without being aware that it's a kind of sickness. Let's say we're always, this is much more common in young people, we're always craving some new man or woman in our life, some new sexual experience. And we get so focused on the object, the person or the experience, that we lose awareness of the fact that we're suffering, that this we're in a state of craving. Roshi Kaplo used to say, everyone needs to awaken to their true nature, but there has to be a felt need. This is a bit of a leap. Suddenly I brought up true nature, but it's all entwined in this. This is the medicine part, but I got a little ahead of myself. Let me just stay with this a little bit longer. There has to be, again, we're talking about the three conditions of getting involved in this, the Dharma. There's the original dukkha, the core pain, unsatisfactoriness. Then there has to be the awareness of that, a felt discontent or dissatisfaction. Now here, I think, is the... let me start again. The core, the original unsatisfactoriness is being, of not simply being perfectly at rest. We can make the case that everyone in the world has this dukkha just by the fact that there is this movement toward things. We go down to Wegmans to get a quart of milk. It's because we're not absolutely perfectly at rest without that quart of milk. We come to a workshop, whether people know it or not, at a workshop, we come because there is some subtle dissatisfaction with our life as it is. We can't be perfectly happy and at rest. Otherwise, we wouldn't have come to the workshop. But it goes even beyond that, as with this example of going out shopping. Every time we go shopping, you can make the case that there is something more we want. What we have is not enough. What we are is not enough. Or anything, doing yoga or anything. Anything, any movement towards something. We wouldn't even be making if we were perfectly, absolutely at peace with what we have. You could say that this, because we need food to sustain ourselves, this is the basic dukkha. We will always be, at some point, craving food if we went long enough without eating, then there would be, that's the craving right there. So we can't get away from that. But then to be aware of this, and this is, I think, the problem, one of the problems with people who have been reared with electronic entertainment and TV and the huge, unbelievable array of pleasures and diversions and fun that we have now. Never before in human existence, surely, I would challenge anyone to argue otherwise, never have human beings had so many diversions, so many ways of entertaining themselves and finding pleasure. Especially in the United States and other highly developed countries. The Dalai Lama, at some point here in the United States, he said, America has perfected samsara. We have taken as far as any people ever had. We have found ways to divert ourselves from the basic dukkha. And electronic entertainment, the internet, video games, computer games, sports, everything on TV, the zillions of channels on cable TV, these all of these things can blunt our awareness of dukkha, not the dukkha, because that's a symptom of dukkha, is spending hours in front of the computer or in front of TV or movies or anything else. That's a symptom of it, but it blunts our awareness of it. It's these things are so pleasurable that we're okay. We're not that dissatisfied, because we can always go to another website or another channel, or find other something. Let's go to another mall, or so. It's not enough to be sick. We have to feel sick. And I think that gets harder and harder to feel. Now, the discontent that brings us, say, to a workshop doesn't have to be an existential crisis. Doesn't have to be a death of someone close to us, or even losing a job, getting fired, or going through a bout of serious illness. That it can be something much more subtle than that. Can this be loneliness? I used to think that people who came to the center all wanted to come, they were aware of wanting to realize themselves, waken to their true nature. It's not true. I've had enough experience asking people in Doksan what their aspiration is, what brought them to the center, and hearing them not mention that. And it also was something of a revelation not that many years ago, when I realized that some people who come to the center and even stay at the center may be looking for a partner or just a community, someone to belong to. They don't have to be searching for their true nature, I mean, consciously. And here's where I come to what I mentioned earlier, out of order, is that you can say that we all have this yearning to awaken to our true nature. Okay, that's just one way of putting it. We all have the yearning to complete ourselves, to find our way out of this estrangement from the world, from others. To have self-consciousness, to be a human being with an intellect that can distinguish between self and other, and us and them, and right and wrong and all these other dualisms that we construct, that we conceive of with our minds, to have that is to feel estranged in some way. It's just root self-consciousness, consciousness of the self, consciousness of other as different from self in some basic way. There's a split. I think this is what Heidegger meant when he said that anxiety is there. It is only sleeping. Its breath quivers perpetually through man's being. Now, when he says it is only sleeping, I think he's talking about that this root dukkha. But then when it starts to stir and we start to become aware that something, there may be something beyond this world of pleasure and pain, of having and not having, of change and not change, beyond the world of physical pain, of endlessly wanting, this is when we are starting to wake up. But the first two are not enough in themselves, the basic dukkha and the awareness of the dukkha, the feeling of discontent. Then there must also be an affinity with the Dharma, with Zen or with Buddhism. Let's say, just keep it simple, the Dharma. Because without that, then this dukkha and awareness of dukkha, the discontent, can go in any other direction as well. It can go to another religion. This is the fuel of religious practice, is this discontent and wondering or confusion or unhappiness. But if there's an affinity with the Dharma, but I see this, there must be, all right, in terms of just Buddhism in general, there has to be some sense of that it makes sense, that Buddhism as a religion makes sense, Buddhism as a belief system, that the four noble truths and the noble eightfold path and so forth make sense. And then one may begin practicing or following Buddhism in some way. But Zen is something else again. I believe that in Zen terms, an affinity with the Dharma means a seeing through the world of phenomena in the broadest sense. Having some kind of faith that there's something beyond form. And of course, form means everything we can conceive of. It means also thought forms. All thoughts, images, notions, fantasies, everything, all the stuff of the mind. I think that people drawn to Zen have, unless it's just purely a social thing, they're looking for a community or a partner, there is some sense of there being, there's got to be something beyond all this phenomenal world, mind phenomena, physical phenomena. There's something beyond all that. There's something else. God itself is a thought form. Belief is a thought form. It's a mind structure. And that's where I think this author, going back to this article, I think that's where we part ways. Is yes, I share his concern that. That something that young people are, there are a lot fewer young people than baby boomers attracted to the Dharma. But what he's proposing is something that I can't see, trying to instill a belief in Buddhism in our children, so that, you know, we can, the whole, the religion will keep going. That's not our way in Zen. We're not trying to instill beliefs in people. We're trying to tear away the beliefs, strip ourselves of these notions, even the belief in Zen as a system. In Zen, it's not about believing, it's about practicing. You don't have to believe anything, practically. You just have to do the practice. All you need to believe in is that the practice can do you some good. Enough so that you'll do it. That's it. Don't believe anything, but do practice. Sit. This is not to make an absolute out of that. I mean, we've always struggled with how to include children here at the center. It's no easy thing when our whole focus is meditation, because children are not ready for meditation. So how do you include them in a meditation-based community? Well, we're finding ways. But we don't want to deny them any understanding of basic Buddhist doctrine, but we also don't want to start force feeding them these things. It's a very fine line. Now, I think that the world will find a way to make more young people aware of dukkha, their own dukkha, sooner or later. That's my guess. Years ago, I was talking about this, how there's still, it's mostly people 45 and older who are coming to practice. And one of our members, one of our charter members, said, "We need another war." And of course, what she meant by this was not that she would wish for one, but that the Vietnam War, and more specifically, the Vietnam War, including the draft, the threat of being drafted, is what drew many of us, that state of ferment. At the time, even had we had endless websites to while away our hours with the threat of the draft and the turmoil of the war, I don't know that we would have been any different. Now, Our society is so tranquilized on the myriad forms of entertainment, and the fact that even with the Iraq War, without the draft, most Americans can just put it out of their minds as it's not a personal thing, a threat of having to go oneself. The whole matter of war and peace and violence and death. Birth and death, actually, is not personalized so much. I think this is why I read articles about how there's a kind of a fawning over soldiers who've been in Iraq. People who meet them in restaurants or airports, they are gushing to them about how grateful they are and everything. I think it's out of guilt. We feel guilty because we don't have to make any sacrifices. They're making all the sacrifices. We just keep shopping, you know. I guess ultimately, the real fuel is this anguish about life and death. That's what the that woman I remember meant about we need another war. That's the real spur to practice. And that's not going to go away. That is the human condition. To go back to basic dukkha, that to be human means to know we're going to die. We're going to be separated from everyone we love. What do we do about that? It's interesting that that even when this awareness of our unsatisfactoriness, awareness of our burden of mortality, even when that wanes, we can still keep practicing. It's not a very vigorous practice. It's not informed by this birth and death, this matter, great matter of birth and death. But if we stick with it long enough, practice, then we get good enough at it to freaking work as a kind of tranquilizer, a calming practice. It's sort of like having a martini or two when you come home. You feel kind of stressed out, so you cross your legs, you do a little sitting, you feel better. And that's better than not sitting at all, just sitting for that reason. I've noticed that some people come to practice that what drives them is a psychological crisis of breaking up with their boyfriend or something like that. And they can do some good sitting in that pain. That's the fuel, that's the spur to try to resolve that pain of that loss. And then practice will do that. Well, so will time. Time will just heal us as the months and the years go by. And then if they're not in touch with the underlying fundamental anguish of being a human being and knowing we're going to die, then when that pain of the breakup of the relationship gets papered over, smoothed over, but then they can disappear. And then maybe sometimes they come back when they realize that salving any particular painful event in one's life is not the answer, any ultimate answer. That the real problem is our human condition and this basic dukkha. Some kind of synchronicity working here. I picked up a Buddha Dharma magazine, and there's a forum among three. Who are they? One guy. His name is Olensky. He's the executive director of the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. So presumably maybe a scholar or maybe a teacher. Blanche Hartman, she was a former abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, and Galen Ferguson, a senior teacher at Naropa. And they're having this discussion of the third of the Four Noble Truths, the truth of cessation, of the going away, the stopping of suffering. And in one part here, they're talking about, again, the first noble truth. You can't talk about one without the other. And this Olensky, he says, "I taught a class full of undergraduates at Brandeis last year. I blithely started with the first noble truth, and I had a major fight on my hands. I spent an hour trying to explain what I meant. They all walked out of there thinking that Buddhism is pretty pessimistic, just as they had thought." That is just the problem. I think with younger people being drawn to this practice is it's hard for them to relate to real suffering. It's hard for them to be aware of this underlying suffering of the human condition. And then this Ferguson responds, in a consumerist culture, you wouldn't usually deliver a product by beginning with unhappiness. But of course, the teachings of Buddhism do go against the stream that there is pleasure and then greater pleasure and then greater pleasure after that. So back, just to tie things up here, back to our koan, medicine and sickness are in correspondence to each other. Isn't it fascinating that it is when it is our becoming aware of our sickness, of our discontent, that we find the medicine? That we can't cure ourselves till we know we're sick. And that awakening, that stirring of awareness of our discontent is itself the response. That's the medicine. One person demonstrated this koan, the medicine and sickness are in correspondence to each other. This isn't the answer to the koan, but I think it's a good stab at it. She said, I'm sick of myself. There, now we're getting somewhere. Now we can start with the healing. We can start with the medicine and move outside of that sickness. The whole earth is medicine. When we have no thoughts in the mind, when we're completely one with our environment, with others, the whole earth is medicine. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.